So like going, kind of dialing right back, the first question you could ask is, well, why chant anything in Buddhism? Like, where does that come from? Isn't this just a sort of like a bit of theism creeping in? I thought the Buddha wasn't into being worshipped as a god. I thought he wasn't interested in that kind of stuff. So some of you will have one or other version of that question. So I suppose, and of course it's difficult to know, isn't it? Because we weren't there 2,500 years ago. But what you can say with confidence is right from the, of course, the Buddhist tradition, the early Buddhist tradition was an oral tradition. And so in that respect, in that tradition, kind of collective, chanting things collectively was a key learning technique. So actually what we've just been doing, people have been doing for 2,500 years, where the kind of, like, for more experienced guys would say, okay, we're going to learn something today, and they'd kind of chant it, and then everybody else would chant it, because there was no book, so you had to remember things. So in that sense, what we're doing is completely traditional. In fact, it's the most traditional thing in Buddhism, is to kind of have collective chants. And without spending too much time on that, there's a number of different kind of things that the early Buddhist community chanted. One of the central things as well, you know, so we've got the refuges and precepts, and we've got this Tiratnavandana. So you could say they represent statements of intent. That's the primary function they form is, this is what I'm interested in, this is what I'm trying to put into practice in my life. And of course, we've got a wide range of levels of experience and commitment for Buddhist path. So exactly what that means will differ for all of us. But that's, you could say that's one of the primary functions, this kind of material. One of the primary functions this material served was a statement of collective purpose. And of course, you could say, well, isn't it enough for me to know what I'm doing in my own head? And of course, that internal direction is most central. But actually, human beings, as we all know, we are profoundly social creatures, and actually a collective sense of expression and orientation supports that personal journey. And yet, well, in a sense, if you didn't think that, you wouldn't be sitting here, because you wouldn't be part of the Sangha if you didn't think that there was any value in that. So that's the first function these kind of chants take, is a collective statement of intent. In the Buddha's time, it was pretty early on, it seems, although of course we're not sure, but one of the things he set up was this: every 2 weeks, the community would meet together and they'd have a collective ritual, as it were. And one of the things they'd do as part of that is they'd chant the Vinaya and the Patimoksha, which were the kind of the monastic community's equivalent of these statements of intent. Much longer, much more complicated, so you guys are getting off relatively easily. So as I say, so one function it forms is that statement of intent. And then of course the other function that these kind of chants form is a tool for reflection. So as we all know, the primary challenge in everything in life, but particularly in Buddhism, is transferring abstract intellectual knowledge into something that actually happens. So Bante famously described it as finding emotional equivalence to our intellectual understandings. But you could say it's not just emotional, it's sort of like it's lived equivalence to our intellectual understandings. And one of the primary ways we achieve that is by, well, kind of like habituating, positively habituating viewpoints and perspectives so that they're inside us, that they come out of us, as it were. You could say, as a brief aside, that's the primary purpose of our study groups. The purpose of our study groups isn't to intellectually understand Buddhism. It's to establish a way of looking on the world which helps us to be free, which presumably Buddhism forms an important component of that, of Dharmic insights too. So that's what we're trying to do, actually. We're trying to create a mindset which is useful to us. Obviously, that's why we're doing it, because actually a Dharmic perspective conduces to freedom, it conduces to happiness, it conduces to making a positive difference in the world. And things like this, Well, in a way, we'll talk about this a bit once I've stopped talking, and I'll get you into little groups and get you to talk about questions and all of that kind of stuff. So one of the questions to be thinking about is, yeah, does things like chanting for refuges and precepts, does that kind of go into you a bit? It's like, oh yeah, these ethical principles, to some extent we're trying to live them out in our lives, and does saying them repeatedly, does that help kind of integrate those perspectives into your lives? My experience has been that it has helped, but you know, obviously we all, yeah, that's a question to explore. What does that look like for you? So, of course, what the tea rattler represents is, if we take the model of the refuges and precepts. So, of course, for refuges are much more condensed, aren't they? It's just to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. So what we've got in the Tea Rat and the Vandana is like a substantial kind of expanding on, okay, so what does that look like? What does that mean? Why are we saying those things? And just for today, we're not going to talk about the precepts because we're focusing on the three jewels. So in that respect, we have. So now we come to the basic structure. So that's a bit of why was this talked about in the Buddha's time? Why did people do this? So now we're going to come on to the kind of the structure of the actual Tea Rat and the Vandana, which in some ways it's, you know, if you've looked at the words in English, it's relatively self-explanatory. So we've got the three jewels, and in each case, we've got kind of. The verse, so the first bit is a praise of that particular jewel, an evocation of its qualities, why it's important, why it's worth going for refuge to. Yeah, so it's, you know, like in the case of the Buddha, we've got such indeed is he, the richly endowed, the free, the fully and perfectly awake, equipped with knowledge and practice, the happily attained, knower of the worlds, guide unsurpassed of men to be tamed, the teacher of gods and men, the awakened one richly endowed. So that's the kind of, that's the verse, as it were, this evocation of, why the Buddha is important, the positive qualities he embodies, what he represents. As I say, we'll be going into that a lot more next time in July, so just to... But that's what happens first. And then you've got the second bit, which is the chorus, which is this, that going for refuge. So the next line is totally explicit, isn't it? All my life I go for refuge to the awakened one. It's quite a thing to say, isn't it? That's certainly when I chant this bit, you know, like we all know that sometimes you drift off and you're thinking about other things, aren't you? I always try to be present for that bit because that feels like quite a significant thing to say, and to be thinking about cheese at that point seems like a shame. Not that it doesn't happen, of course, but I do try to be, in a sense, that's the pivot point of the whole thing, isn't it? So you've got what's good about it, then you've got what you're going to do about it, and then you've got kind of going into that in more detail. So then we have this, the rest of the chorus. To all the awakened of the past, to all the awakened yet to be, to all the awakened that now are, my worship flows unceasingly. No other refuge than the wake, refuge supreme is there for me. Oh, by the virtue of this truth, may grace abound and victory. So as you'll be... kind of be familiar with this image of going for refuge is a central one in the Buddhist tradition, and again you have these moments in the Pali Canon where the Buddha's met somebody and they've really communicated or something's happened, and the person in question has found is that this is valuable, this is important, this means something, and their response is to go for refuge, to say this is, I want this value or this principle to be present in my life as a guiding principle. So that's what we're doing when we're going for refuge. And of course, the way that, what that looks like in our individual lives, the intensity which we feel that, the way in which it plays out, always differs. But that's the kind of, that's the core movement of Buddhism, you could say, is finding better and better sources of refuge. Yeah, and that's like, I could go into a whole spiel about refugees, but let's not do that today. But I suppose probably the crucial thing to say at this point is to remember that although it's language which might not seem that familiar to us, the business of going for refuge is entirely human, and that's what we're doing all the time. We go for refuge to our jobs, we go for refuge to our homes, we go for refuge to our sexual partners, our children, our parents, our senses of identity, who we are in the world. We're constant. It's, in a way, I think it's interesting because the language of going for refuge can seem quite alien. It's like, what does that mean? But actually, it's like, that's what we're constantly doing. We're seeking security, we're seeking certainty, we're seeking pleasure. What is the right thing to do here? That's what going for refuge is. We're doing it all the time. We're constantly. And all Buddhism is saying, hey folks, what is maybe these kind of values, these principles are better values and principles to guide your lives, put most simply. And of course, it's not that you stop having, it's not like you stop going for refuge to other things, because it's more like these are the kind of like the meta, not M-E-double-T-A, but M-E-T-A, the kind of like the architectural structure of how we look at the world. So, like the Buddha as the possibility of human growth, the potential, our capacity for growth, our limitless capacity for unfoldment to wisdom, to kindness, to energy, to freedom. The Dharma is the, the principle in the universe which we can employ to access those states of freedom, awakening. And the Sangha as being, the human support network, which is social creatures we rely upon to live. And I always think more importantly, the evocation of the possibility of human relationships, which I, as many as you will know, because I say this quite a lot, for me, that's what I'm most interested in. What I'm interested in is what happens when human beings are not relating on that inevitable basis of like, who's smarter, who's funnier, da da da, all of that kind of crap which gets in the way. What is humanity capable when people are relating to each other on the basis of awareness and kindness and freedom? What can we do? And the answer is there is no limit. And that's what, that's why I'm here, that's why I work at the Buddha Center, because that's what I'm interested in. So that's, as I say, so that's the basic structure, as it were. So you get this evocation of the quality of a free jewel, and then the sort of a statement of movement towards it. So just to say a little bit more about kind of where this comes from in the Pali Canon. So there's particularly these bits where the core of the verses, as it were, where these evocations of the positive qualities of the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, they're kind of littered throughout the Pali Canon. They're all over the place. Sometimes they appear on their own, sometimes they appear together. Well, you could have an interesting conversation about the Buddha's relationship with arrogance. But I suppose the short version of that would be that the Buddha's free from all those preoccupations. He has no ego to defend, so therefore when people start saying to him, hey, you're like this, he's like, yeah, well, that's true. There's nothing, sometimes, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where we're trying to make ourselves bigger than we are, and we're using words to do that. That can feel quite messy, and sometimes people just say, hey, you're really good at this, and you're like, yeah, you know what, that's true. There's no conceit, there's no arrogance there, you've got nothing to prove. It's just like, yeah, it is true, I am really good at that, actually. So we see both happening. We say sometimes people say this to Buddha, and they say, Buddha, you're like this. And sometimes the Buddha, in the course of conversation, says, I'm like this. So just to go a little bit into one of the stories, and again, in a way, evoking why this might be a useful practice for us. So there's the Mahanama Sutta, which is in the Anguttara Nikaya. And what's interesting about it is Mahanama's just a normal guy, he's a family guy, he's not being a monk, he's not off kind of doing all of that, but he's been on retreat with the Buddha. So you have these, the Buddha kind of wandered around, but during the rainy season, the hardest time of the year where it's difficult to move around, the Buddha would stay in one place and everybody would meditate together and be together. So the Buddha's just, it's the end of the rainy season and the Buddha's just about to go. We did this recently in our study group, so those of you might remember it from my group. So the Buddha's just about to go, and this guy Mahanama is kind of like, he's had a really good time, he's really kind of gone deeper in meditation, he's had a really positive time, and he's like, but he's aware that partly that's because of the conditions and because the Buddha's been around. So basically he goes up to the Buddha and says, "So Buddha, you're going now. I'm not going anywhere. I've got to stay home and look after my family and go to work. What am I going to do now? How am I going to practice?" And the Buddha says, "Mahanama, that's a really good question. That's a really important question." He often says that to people. And he says, first of all, you need to maintain a good quality of mindfulness that you've had from retreat. And then you need to bring to mind your ideals, your aspirations. And he goes on to kind of talk about the verses of the three jewels and saying, you know, it's good to recollect these things, it's good to dwell on them. Yeah. I'll just read the bit he says after, I'll just read the whole thing. There is the case when you recollect the Tathagata, the Buddha. Indeed, the Blessed One is worthy and rightly self-awakened, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well gone, an expert with regard to the world, unexcelled as a trainer for those people fit to be trained, tamed, the teacher of divine and human beings, awakened, blessed. So that's the verse in a slightly different translation. At any time when a disciple of the Noble One is recollecting the Tathagata, his mind is not overcome with passion, not overcome with aversion, not overcome with delusion. His mind heads straight, based on the Tathagata. And when the mind is headed straight, the disciple of the Noble One gains a sense of a goal, gains a sense of a Dharma, gains joy connected with the Dharma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. That sounds nice, doesn't it? Rapture, calm, ease. So obviously that's, the Buddha repeatedly said, check it out for yourselves. Like, is that true? Does it? That's what the Buddha's suggesting, that by bringing to mind our ideals, our positive aspirations, that has a positive effect on our bodies, on our minds. For those of you who like neuroscience, I like neuroscience, as you know, I was talking to a friend recently and they were telling me about a scientist who spent 10 years in Thailand doing neuroscience on those like hardcore monks who meditate in the jungle and all of that and kind of meet tigers. You might have heard stories about them. And so my friend asked this woman, she said, "So give me the pith of what you learned in 10 years doing neuroscience on these guys who meditate for hours and hours every day in the jungle and all of that." And what the woman said, which surprised my friend and I found interesting, she said, "What you expect is what you will get." That was her, that's her primary conclusion she's drawn from 10 years of studying these guys. For where you place your limit determines how far you go, where you will get to. So if you meditate for a bit of relaxation, then you will get a bit of relaxation. If you meditate with a sense of vision and possibility of the limitless potential of a human mind, then you will move towards the limitless potential of the human mind. Of course, it's not quite as easy as that, is there? Because we're complicated human beings. But I found that very, very striking. Where you place your limits determines how far you will go. So you could say that's why Buddhism talks in terms of such high ideals. It's like actually the greater your sense of what is possible, the more you will fully be able to realise it. Okay. So just a little bit more for me and then we'll go into questions. So in some ways, coming much more back down to earth, you could say, well, why do we chant this in Triratna? I suppose hopefully I've evoked some of the reason why we might do this in Triratna, because it's a way of connecting with the Buddha, it's a way of connecting with a sense of history. 2,500 years, people have been coming together to kind of chant these words in Pali and bring to mind what's important in their lives. So it's us tapping into a very rich and vivid ancient tradition. On a completely pragmatic note, you might say, why don't we just chant for refuges and precepts? They're shorter, they're quicker. get on with it sooner. Well, for a start, I'd invite you to relate to the chanting as part of the meditation rather than the annoying bit to be get over with before you start the meditation. That will help your life because it's an extra 6 minutes of meditation. So it's this thing about orientating ourselves. It's like so in a sense, the most important part of meditation is the attitude you bring to it and for what you do immediately after you stop meditating. So actually it's like using this the time of chanting to actually bring to mind, here I am about to meditate because I want to grow, because whatever, you know, like whatever form and way in which you express your ideals. Yeah, like in some of these words you'll connect with. And as you go through the chanting, really, some of the lines you'll like and some bits you'll be like, what the hell does that mean? I don't care about that. That's quite human, that's quite natural. It's like, as long as, there just have to be enough bits where you're like, oh yeah, I connect with that. One of the ones I like is, so in this first stanza, knower of the worlds, knower of the worlds. What does that mean? The way that Subhuti explained it, which I found really evocative, is what that's saying is that the Buddha understand all kinds of different worlds of experience. So often, you know, we live in a little world, we live in our own little worlds, don't we? So one of the functions of the more awakened you are, the more able you are to imaginatively inhabit different worlds and communicate to those different worlds. So what I think that phrase is saying is that the freedom that the Buddha had to communicate wasn't partial, it wasn't limited, it wasn't just for North Indian guys 2,500 years ago. It wasn't just for men, it wasn't just for Indians, it wasn't just for men, it wasn't just for people 2,500 years ago. What he's saying has got sufficiently broad appeal that it can be relevant to anybody who's got an experience of consciousness. So that's what it means to know the worlds, to see what it is that people in completely different situations need to hear. In a sense, he could see our time, he could see our minds, because his ability to express what is essential to human experience ran so deep for what he was saying was relevant to us 2,500 years later in a completely different world. And sometimes you have to do a bit of work to get past the secretions of language, and not everything he said does that. But I think of enough of it does, which is, so that's, yeah, just as an example. So that's one of the lines in it. I try to, when I'm chanting with Tiwa and Navandra, I try to remember, I think, oh yeah, kind of knower of the world. That inspires me, that moves me. On an even more pragmatic level, I think one of the reasons why we chant this in Tri Ratna is because for refuges and precepts, of course, as you know, the order members take 10 precepts. So it's like that's slightly, when we're chanting for refuges and precepts, it's slightly like it's not quite the same, is it? Whereas for Tri Ratna Vantanu is common, everybody's got that in common. So I personally, that's one of the reasons I like it, because it's a unifier between our community, between us. Yeah, so I think that's enough. So just to summarise what I've been trying to say, I suppose most briefly I've been trying to say that chanting has always been present within the Buddhist tradition, and so there's nothing weird or kind of theistic about it. The Buddha did it. because it's a way of personally calling to mind our values and connecting with other people who share those values, and there's a power and potency in that. And by bringing to mind those values, it helps us embody those for more and more fully, which is why we're doing this. Which is why I encourage you in the coming weeks, as we're chanting this on a Wednesday night, to have... you're going to have a choice at the end of the evening. You either keep this piece of paper and bring it next week, or you give it back to me so you can have it again next week. But we have got plenty of puja books as well, so it won't be... if you've keep it and then lose it, that's okay. But for the first while we're doing it, do have a book in front of you so you can be looking at the words while you're doing it. Buddhism isn't into saying things where you don't know what it means, or yeah, sometimes there's a bit of a lag, but it's really important to be looking at the words and saying, okay, so this is what this means. And in a way, it's a bit of a litmus test. To what extent do I connect with these words? To what extent do I feel affinity with these words? And as I say, it's a sliding scale. Some days, some bits you'll love, some bits you'll think, what does that mean? And some days you'll be into it, and some days you'll be thinking about something else. That's human. What we're about is about developing a momentum of consciousness towards awareness and kindness and clarity. And ritual helps with that. Yeah, again, I have absolutely no doubt in my mind. Some of the rituals that I do, sometimes, I can just feel them. And it's like, oh, why am I doing this? And it's like, actually, it creates a momentum in my mind, a momentum in my life, which persists.